heavens above, you make my sad heart jump with joy. And when you're near, I just can't sit still a minute. I'm so, oh, Johnny, please tell me, dear.
In case you've been living on Mars, Jim Lehrer is the anchor and executive editor of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS, and he often serves as a moderator of presidential debates. But on the side, he's also been a prolific novelist. He was a guest on this show in April to discuss his latest, Oh Johnny, which is his 19th. We heard from listeners that they enjoyed it, so we thought we would play it again for you as we begin the 4th of July weekend. I started off by remarking that 19 is a lot of novels, even for a full-time author, let alone a full-time news anchor, and I asked him how it compared with the number of novels Joyce Carol Oates has written.
Oh, probably 119. She is just incredible.
But still, 19 is a great output, and you're also doing all that other stuff.
All that other stuff, yeah. Yeah, well, you got to, yeah. You know, it's the old story. I've discussed this before, that I found out some years ago that I have time to do the things I really want to do, if I really want to do them. And that's
if you don't
the key
sleep, you can do it.
No. I can do it. You just have to use the awake time a little more efficiently, that's all.
Were you inspired at all by that song by the Andrews Sisters?
You know, not the story itself, but I knew once I decided on the story and this character, this kid, that I was going to call him Johnny, and I love that. I'd always loved that song, Oh Johnny, Oh Johnny, Oh.
It's an odd song because it was written during World War I, but became a huge hit during World War II.
Exactly. And How You Can Love is a key, of course, part of the novel too. So it also fit. If anybody hears the song, they'll know what I'm talking about too.
Well, Johnny, your protagonist, has been signed to play baseball in Detroit, but then he joins the Marines. And that kind of derails his plans. Not just for him. There was a whole generation of ball players who went off to war.
That's right. Some of them stayed. I mean, they went into the military, but they were asked. They had semi-pro baseball leagues for various military bases. But some of them decided they didn't want to play baseball. They wanted to be real military people. So there were two kinds of professional baseball players during World War II, those who played ball and those who played war.
Well, the focus of the story seems to be more on what it's like to reenter life, or in Johnny's case, to start a life after returning from war. And that's something that we've been talking a lot about these days.
That's right. That's essentially his story. I mean, he, as a kid, 17, 18 years old, had some experiences that before the term was created, post-traumatic stress disorder or syndrome, and whatever you want to call it, he certainly suffered from it, as you say, many of these kids are today.
And is that one of the inspirations for the book, thinking about that and how it probably was true of pretty much every war, although we don't talk about. I guess it was shell shock in World War I.
It's called shell shock. That's exactly what it was called. You know what? When looking back on it, I wasn't consciously thinking about that. However, all of that was going on at the time I was writing this book, particularly those early times when there were stories and great concern about the fact that that problem wasn't being dealt with properly by the Veterans Administration and the Pentagon and all of that. And we were doing stories on the NewsHour about it, as was everyone else. And it must have played a role, because once I got him into that situation, and he was a flamethrower operator, which is a traumatic thing to do anyhow. It's probably the single most deadly weapon, personally, that you could use in war. I'm sure it played a role, but I wasn't consciously thinking about it.
Well, it's a horrific weapon, because if you shoot somebody, you might not even be aware of what happened. But a flamethrower, you see the person burn up.
You see the person burn up. And also, I later learned, because I was later a Marine in the 50s myself, and was for a while a platoon leader of an anti-tank assault platoon and an infantry battalion. Well, an anti-tank assault, that's where the flamethrowers are, and they have other things too, explosives and all of that. So I knew, I used a flamethrower, I knew what it was like. But the other thing about a flamethrower operator, and this is why it's so, thing about Johnny, my made-up character, is that a flamethrower operator's life expectancy in combat in World War II for a Marine was about zero. Because, for your point, you shoot that flame, and then everybody on the other side says, "Wow!" Well, everybody shoots right at where that flame started. And so the first thing they trained, including Johnny, the first thing they taught Johnny was you shoot your flame and then you run like hell. Because you, and that's what, you know, if you don't, you get killed.
I'm always fascinated by the details in a novel. For example, he has signed to play with the Tigers. He would have been a minor leaguer with the Tigers. But if he had come back and played with the Tigers, the Tigers won the World Series in 1945 with one of the greatest teams of their time, Hank Greenberg, Hal Neuhauser, Dizzy Trout. Virgil Trucks left the Navy and joined them at the end. I mean, that was an extraordinary team. Why did you pick the Tigers?
I just want
to make Detroit feel good?
No. One of my grandfathers lived in Michigan for a while, and he lived in a place, a little tiny town outside of Kalamazoo, but he was a big Detroit Tiger fan. And I've always loved baseball, and I was a big baseball person. And I thought I just owed it to my grandfather. And I was just thinking about the Tigers. There was no special, I was not trying to make a special case for the poor folks of Detroit. I talked to somebody from Detroit recently and asked me that. Why, were you trying to throw us a bone or something in our troubled time? No. Nothing that gracious.
My guest is Jim Lehrer, whose novel, Oh, Johnny, is published by Random House. While he's on a train to California, heading to fight in the Pacific, a fellow Marine tells Johnny, there are no happy dead virgins. And so he has 30 minutes to stop over in Wichita.
Yeah.
And that is an important 30 minutes in his life. Right.
Well, and for a lot of reasons. First of all, it was his first trip down that particular lane, but it was also the girl was the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen in his life. She just happened to be one of these young women who met the troop trains to bring cigarettes and coffee and that sort of thing. And he just saw her in the crowd, and she saw him and liked what each other saw, and they just fell into this kind of experience. During the stopover, they found a place there at the Wichita, Kansas train station and changed their lives, obviously.
And we'll get to what happened
when
he returns. Not a surprising thing. He's like many men at the time who enlisted to go to war. Does that seem almost like an old-fashioned notion today? Because enlistments are way down these days, probably because of people not wanting to go to Iraq or Afghanistan, but also because people keep on being sent back again
again. That's right. It's not surprising that enlistments have, in the last several months, increased because of the economic situation. But before that, the Marines have always done very well. They've never had a trouble meeting their quotas, but the Army was really having a problem. What they were doing, because of Iraq, they were having to lower the standards. High school used to be required. It depends on various times whether a high school diploma was required or not. Certain things, weight, height, stuff, all that kind of stuff. And depending on what the demand was for personnel or for recruits was, versus what was available. But right now, they're getting top drawer recruits because of the economic situation.
So Johnny winds up seeing battle in Peleliu and in Okinawa. And referring to his experience in battle, you write, Johnny had so much never to tell anyone. Why do you think people who've endured horrific experiences are often really reluctant to talk about them?
Well, I think what the people who've done studies on this have shown, I read a lot of these in preparation right for writing this novel, is that particularly after World War II, there were horrific experiences are a two-way street. It's what is done to you and what you've observed, and also what you have done yourself. And there was those who actually did something themselves that they considered horrific, which is take the life of another human being in a rough situation, like a flamethrower,
or people in the Holocaust who had to do things to just keep themselves alive.
Exactly. And so what they decided, and it became kind of a mass decision. Most of the survivors, or the veterans, let's put it that way, the veterans of the World War II, just decided as a group to kind of put that behind them.
Can you do that?
Well,
I mean, today we talk about people, the lack of mental health facilities. There just aren't enough out there. But we're aware of the fact that people do need some form of therapy.
That's right. They didn't get it after World War II, and a lot of them took their own lives. A lot of them had serious drinking problems, drug problems, and all of that, all of which were never really out there on the front pages of anybody's newspaper or on anybody's newscast, including, you know, on public broadcasting. It just was not a public. The war was over. We won. Let's get on with victory. And that was the attitude.
But do you think that even today that this is something that's being adequately covered in the news?
Well, there are certain times.
Usually what happens is somebody shoots up a shopping mall, and then we say, he just did not get all of the help he probably required after returning from Vietnam or from Afghanistan or Iraq.
Yeah, the one time when there was attention properly paid was because of good journalism. Washington Post series on Walter Reed and disclosed cleanly, clearly, unequivocally, that these kids were not being properly taken care of, and particularly their mental problems and traumatic problems.
What sustains Johnny is the thought that he's going to come home to this girl, Betsy, helps him overcome some of the worst things. Of course, it doesn't work out.
He comes back,
she's married.
Yeah, he comes back from the war, you know, with these two dreams. This is a dream to be a ball player, and now the dream to find Betsy. And he believes that he survived all of that awfulness that he experienced in war because of Betsy, because of that 30-minute experience he had by chance in the train station in Wichita, Kansas. And that's why, you know, he wants to have a life with her. That's the dream number two that goes with dream number one, which is to be a ball player.
So he doesn't wind up with a career in baseball. He doesn't get the girl of his dreams. He's lost his naivete. He's also lost hope and a sense of optimism.
Yeah. He had a rough time. I mean, he's a classic case of what's called post traumatic syndrome, post trauma. Yeah,
we'll say PTSD.
PTSD. He struggled with it, and he's a good kid. I mean, I got to where I really knew him by the time, obviously, I wrote the book. I mean, you have to, and I really liked the kid, and I felt some very real, great sorrow for him.
But do you think that loss of hope and optimism is one of the less obvious damages of war?
You know, I don't know if it's possible to generalize on that, because there are a lot of people come out of combat situations changed in different ways, in all kinds of different ways. Some people come are not refreshed, but they feel like they've accomplished something. And the horror was worth. You know, it's hard to. I think it's hard to generalize.
My guest is Jim Lehrer, whose latest novel. I always feel odd saying that. Anyway, his latest novel, his 19th, is called Oh Johnny. It is published by Random House, and we will continue our conversation. Oh, we're not doing a break. Oh, I'm so pleased. You see, do they tell you whether you're doing a break or not when you're doing your show?
No.
Oh. So you just have to kind of know that.
Yeah. They don't tell you?
I guess somebody must have told me somebody somewhere down the line.
You have to start writing this stuff down.
One of the things that not only is Betsy married, but she's also become quite religious. And she's become a member of a group that I never heard of before.
Well, I made up.
Oh, you made it up.
Yeah.
No wonder I never heard of it.
It's a Randallite. It's called Randallites. I made it up because I didn't want to offend anybody, and I also wanted to use pieces of various real denominations. Don't look for a Randallite church in your hometown because there ain't one.
She tells Johnny that she married a man who was a conscientious objector who participated in the Minnesota starvation experiment. Did you make that up too?
No, that's real. I mean, the Minnesota Starvation Project was real. Yes, that was real. There's a whole book about that. I read that book.
So is that what happens? Books come in and a little piece of this, a little piece of that, and something
that
happens on your show, and soon the basic elements of a novel start forming?
Yeah, yeah. What's so wonderful about it, why I love doing it so much, and why I've done it so often, is that it can start, like in this case with Johnny, was thinking about the train station and the troop train. That's all I knew about when I started. And then I made him a baseball player. And then, you know, the experience of it. And then one thing led to another. And who's this woman? And what's the religion? And then and then you just kind of follow the nose of the story and the smell of the story.
And you also use elements from your own life because
he ends up
getting a job at a bus company. Buses are something you know more than a little about.
That's
your
right.
father worked at a bus company.
Yeah, so did I.
And you also have collected bus memorabilia over the
years.
What kinds of things do you have in your collection?
I have about 250 old bus depot signs, these small porcelain signs where they put them in front of a drugstore or grocery store in small towns. I've got 300 bus drivers' cap badges. They were, you know, from all of these go back to the 20s and the 30s up to the present.
Where do you find these things?
Well, when I first started collecting them, what I would do, I'd just write the companies, write them a note and say, hey, I collect this stuff. You got any? And sometimes people just give it to me. And then I'd pick them up at flea markets and all of that. Now eBay it's all on eBay. But there's still people who know I'm a bus collector and keep me in mind. And I have had to diminish my activities in collecting because I don't have room for this stuff anymore. And I have an older brother who also is a bus person, and he also collects. So a lot of the stuff I've given to him, I've given some of it to. There's a bus museum in Hershey, Pennsylvania, Museum of Bus Transportation it's called, and some of my stuff is on the walls of that museum, which is also part of the Antique Car Museum. So I'm a bus nut, but not a complete nut about it.
Well, when was the last time you traveled any great distance in a bus?
Well, on a commercial bus, it's been a while. I own a bus of my own. I have a 1947 flexible Clipper that I have restored, and my dad had a little bus company in Kansas in the 40s and went bankrupt after 1 year. And I have this bus painted the colors that my dad had and put the names on the side of the towns and all that sort of stuff, called Kansas Central Line. So
you didn't do the hippie thing with the bus.
I didn't do the hippie. No. I keep it, we have a little place outside of Washington, and my grandsons love to drive it. That's about the end of it.
One of the reasons that I was really impressed that you published this novel this year is that you were kind of busy. You moderated the first presidential debate between John McCain and Barack Obama in September, although that's nothing new for you. You've done 1 year, didn't you,
done
do
11.
All the debates?
Yeah, I've done it a couple times. Yeah, I've done 11 altogether.
But they require preparation. Then
oh,
you
God,
have
yes.
your. I know my daily show requires a lot of preparation, and then sometimes I have to do stuff after hours that relate to the show. And I can't imagine writing a novel.
Yeah.
I've been asked, you know, many times people have asked me, do you want to write a book? And I've said, sure, sometime.
Sometime. Well, see, the answer, what that means, when you say that, your answer says that it really doesn't mean that much to you. Because if your answer was, yes, I'm going to write a book, you would write a book. And because it really, you know, a young person, just happened to be a young person, I'm not, it could have been any age person, said to me once recently, well, I've got a book I want to write, but, and I'm Mr. Lehrer, I just don't have time and to write the book. And I said, well, have you got time to write one page a day? Oh, sure. I said, well, what if you wrote one page a day for 300 days? How many pages would you have? And he said, oh, I got it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. You'd have a book, wouldn't you? Uh-huh. Because most of them are about 300 pages long.
In the past,
that's how I do it.
Getting into the other part of your life, yep. In the past we've spoken about objectivity, and you've said objectivity isn't a real requirement, but fairness is.
Right.
What do you think about, well, I'm sure many people have asked you about Fox News, but also now we have the liberal equivalent on MSNBC with Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow. What do you think of those shows?
Well, I think that, first of all, I'm a more the merrier type person. I mean, the more voices we can have, whether liberal, conservative, whatever, it's great. That's what's so wonderful about this whole revolution in cable television and whatever. The only thing that worries me is, and it does worry me a lot, is that in the beginning there has to be a straight news story. Before the people go left wing, right wing, before they shout, before they tell jokes as Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert or David Letterman or whatever about the news. In the beginning, there's got to be a shared set of facts. What exactly is it that President Obama said? What exactly did the Republicans say about this, that, for instance? And then you start all the other things. And you and I've talked about this before, the three things about journalism. They're phase one, what happened? Phase two, what does it mean? That's analysis. Phase three, what should I think about it? That's opinion. These are three separate legitimate functions in journalism. They shouldn't be done by the same people. Each three different sets of folks should be doing those three things.
Well, you're in public television, so you have certain freedom to do these kinds of things that maybe commercial television shows don't have. I noticed one major difference is the nightly news shows all seem to end up with an upbeat human interest story.
Yeah.
At the end of your shows, you run a list of servicemen and women who were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. I have said this before to a couple of times to people that about reality television, that's the business I'm in. You know, I mean, yeah, occasionally there'll be things that make people laugh. And if it's a real situation, that's fine. But not in the artificial laughter business and the reality of war. I really do believe, in a neutral way, people should be involved in that. Every American should know that these kids who died in Afghanistan today or in Iraq today, they died in our names, wearing the uniforms of our country. It's just a small point, but it's the one that needs to be made.
Do you worry that with the shrinking of many of our greatest newspapers and the possible demise of some have already died, and the Boston Globe right now is on its last legs, that we are going to know a lot less about the world than we might have in the past?
I am worried. I'm extremely worried about that. But the only thing, and I'm basically optimistic, as I'm sure you are. You can't do what we do for a living and not be optimistic, because you have to believe that there are solutions to these problems, or you wouldn't be asking questions about them. You couldn't do it. So I'm optimistic. We cannot let this happen. In other words, we the United States of America, we the Americans, and the small we the journalists cannot let this happen. The big we can't let it happen because our democratic society is based on an informed electorate. Without it, we haven't got it. We don't have a working democratic society. So the newspapers are in trouble now. Through some series of, and everybody's panicked about it, and that panic is leading to a lot of, I think, constructive discussion, finally, about what we're going to do about it.
Well, the big problem for the newspapers is it's very expensive if you're a paper like the Post or the Times.
Absolutely.
To keep people in offices all over the world and really do the job you want to do. And advertising has shrunk, and
Absolutely.
Now there's the competition of the Internet, the younger younger readers are no longer coming to the newspapers.
You just laid out the whole thing. So the Walter Reed story, for instance, a classic case. The Walter Reed story came about because the Washington Post, a couple of editors, got a tip from somebody, an anonymous tip about what was going on at Walter Reed, how they were not taking care of these kids when they came back from Afghanistan and Iraq properly. They assigned two investigative reporters, two of their best reporters, and gave them 4 months and unlimited resources to work on that story. And that's not going to happen as often as it used to, on a local level as well as a national level. And that's the thing that we have got to worry about, and that's the thing we've got to do something about.
Well, we no longer have the kind of investigative reporting luxury that we had with Woodward and Bernstein and Watergate. Who knows what would have happened if Watergate had occurred in today's news environment.
It's a good question.
But even after that, I asked Ben Bradley once why, after the great success of Watergate, the Washington Post had done so little on the SNL scandal.
Yeah.
And he said the stuff that has to do with business and math and numbers just is too overwhelming for the audience. Now, here we are going through this incredible economic crisis, and I'm sure that this is a major problem for you. How do you explain some of these complicated stories?
We're working very hard on this. We have put tremendous number of resources, both personnel and otherwise, in trying to explain each one of these things. Actually is a derivative? What do you mean subprime mortgage? What is the connection between, a particular loan and overnight Fed rates and all that sort of stuff? We are devoting a tremendous amount of time to it because I believe it's crucial that people understand this. It's just like it's crucial they understand a foreign policy issue or anything else. This affects everybody.
And one of the complaints that many people have had about the way network television, I don't mean to pick on network television,
sure,
but the way they cover the news or radio, is that we don't give enough context.
Yeah.
And context is really how you understand what a problem is all about.
Exactly. I agree with that. And the other side of the coin, people accuse us of giving too much context sometimes, but I'll take that one. But if you don't do the context, then you don't know the going in or you don't even have and you don't have any way to look ahead if you don't have context. It's all just boom, just like the traffic accident. But how did those two cars happen to both have red lights at the same time? Or have green lights at the same. What is it? What caused the collision? Or if you don't know that, you don't explain it. It's going to continue to happen.
I understand that you go to Wichita, Kansas, when you want to do your serious writing. Will we be seeing you going off for a little while to Wichita again anytime soon?
I have just been to Wichita because this book took place. I went by there, and I spent a couple of days working on a new book.
Oh, you already have another novel in the works?
Well, I have a new one's already done. No, this is the one after that I'm working on.
The 21st.
You got to stay busy. I'm working on it. I'm working on one. That's the Kennedy assassination thing.
I know you're only doing them so that you can come and visit us on the show.
It's for you I'm doing this. It's for you and your listeners that I'm doing this. For WNYC.
Jim Lehrer's Oh Johnny, his 19th, already 21st in the works. It's published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Hey, the pleasure is always mine, my friend.